welcome to the John, Paul, and Mike Show. My name is Paul Holmes.
My name is John Jurisic.
And we are here at the Greater Victoria Chamber of Commerce office recording today. Because we're kind of the mobile media here, aren't we, John?
Yeah, we're the mobile digital media. We're very cool. We're very hip. At least that's what I tell myself every day.
And we're pretty excited to be here. Sitting with us is the Economic Development Officer, Dallas Gislason. Is that, am I saying that?
That's correct. Yeah,
Gislason? Gislason? You know, I've been saying Gislason for a while. That's not right, though.
That's pretty much how I say it, too, actually.
Is
I,
it?
To be honest, I don't actually know how it's pronounced because it's an Icelandic name.
Oh, so, is it?
Yeah.
Wow.
So, I just hope that my family's been pronouncing it right for all these years.
Anyway, Dallas is with the Greater Victoria Development Agency. And why don't we just kick it off and just tell us what the heck is this Greater Victoria Development Agency, Dallas?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Greater Victoria Development Agency is basically the region's economic development office. So if you look at any North American city or any city in the world, rather, those cities would have an economic development office looking after things like the growth rates, the unemployment rate, the employment rate, the growth trends, the top employers, looking at keeping those top employers active and engaged in the community, all those sorts of things. So that's what the GVDA is. We're a little bit different than what you would find in other cities in British Columbia in that we're actually a nonprofit organization governed by a board of directors, unlike what you'd see in a city, let's say Nanaimo or Kelowna, where you have a municipal corporation owned by the municipality, which is governed by city staff and things like that, right?
Well, Dallas, I've been passionate about economic development for better part of 20 years, and while being involved with the chamber in the mid-2000s helped develop GVDA. And, of course, one of its primary tenets, as you have just now identified, was to try to be an industry voice, to not entirely represent municipal political interests, which sometimes don't entirely favor business interests. How has that been have you been able to capture that industry flavor and industry desire through the years, and how does it look today?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great insight, John. And of course, I have to thank you as kind of a founding father, if you will, of the GVDA. It's been around for about 7 years. Started in 2007, and over that time, it was really designed, like you said, with that industry makeup around the board, and we say industry and stakeholder because, of course, we have some major stakeholders like the post-secondary institutions, like the Harbor Authority, that are, if you will, major kind of stewards of the economy. They play an important role. But that's exactly it. If you look at what is an economy is really a bunch of human interactions and business interactions. And so if a municipality is looking at intervening in that from a, you know, there's always that risk of this political interference or something like that. The GVDA is really designed to kind of go above and beyond that and say, at the macro level, what are the functions that are required to make the economy perform at a better level than it was yesterday, if mm-hmm. you will. Yeah.
Well, first of all, Dallas, I want to thank you for referring to John as a founding father because now I have a new nickname for him.
So, you've called me many things in the past, Paul.
I'm pretty excited about this
many
one,
many of
though.
Which we can't say on online.
At least not on this, PG rated, podcast. So, yes, so did I get sidetracked there again, John?
Absolutely.
I got a little sidetracked.
Paul, yeah. It's Monday morning. We're not in our game. We're going to go around in circles, maybe.
perhaps. All right. And waking up, more coffee. Dallas, a huge, issue. From my perspective, I'm 40 years old now. I'm 41 years old now. Oh my God.
So you could have been a founding father.
I could have been a founding father alongside with you, signing my John Hancock. Anyway, and, you know, I still think of myself as 18 because, you know, that's about the point when boys stop mentally developing. Is that right? Mm-hmm. Is that about right, John?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, big issue for me is youth in this region who graduate from high school, they go to university, maybe they go somewhere else for university. They'd really love to live in Victoria and work in Victoria and maybe get married and buy a house or a condo and start a family and be able to afford all of that. Where are we with that?
Yeah, that's a great insight. And that's been a discussion around our board table for a long time, engaging young people, you know. For us, it's really a matter – let me pause there. So think about the fundamental transformation that's occurring in our economy right now today in Victoria. And that is we're moving away from being a government town. And not that we're not a government town. We are a government town. But we're moving away from being this primary just government, and moving into this exciting new era of private sector and entrepreneurship. And that's been occurring for the last few years. As we see the emergence of high tech and gaming companies. Now, there's now 19 gaming companies in the community. So if you look at the chart, it's a significant
exponential growth.
Yeah, exponential growth curve in that area, right? Yeah. And those are employers that, you know, most likely are employing young people being, you know, 20 to 35 kind of early careerists, let's call them. So if you think about from an economic development perspective, what do you want to happen? Well, what you want to happen is more of those jobs being created. Because young people, most of the ones I've met don't work for free. And a lot of them don't either want to work for government, or what you have in the government is you have people that are government careerists that have been there in those positions for a long time and essentially need to vacate those positions in order for new ones to be created. Because today no longer is government a growth sector. In fact, we've lost 1900 jobs over the last 3 years in the public sector in Victoria.
Oh, wow.
So, our private sector needs to offset that in order to maintain kind of status quo employment levels, right? The other thing that's happening is Victoria is arguably one of the best cities in Canada to attract lifestyle or values driven individuals. That's something that, you know, people come here that want to go kayaking after work. Mm-hmm. And so if you think about in terms of our the cities across Canada, you have some high level executives on Bay Street, downtown Toronto, that work 15-hour days, and are recruiting and attracting and people that are driven to that lifestyle gravitate towards those jobs and those employers, right? Victoria is the opposite. We attract people that are lifestyle oriented or values driven individuals, right?
Right.
So the types of companies that are started here are started by people that have those similar values, and they tend to gravitate and attract more of those like-minded individuals. So that, in my view, our job is to attract more values-driven entrepreneurs that create companies that attract other values-driven young people.
Okay. Yeah. I know John's a big kayaker. Is that right, John?
Founding father and kayaker.
And kayaker. Correct. Okay. Awesome. So there's another industry group in Victoria that I like to refer to as BILS, basement industry leaders. And it's these, organizations who are quite literally started in somebody's basement and go on to lead entire industries. They're the number one. And we don't hear about these companies. They exist. We know they exist. I if you dig pretty deep, you can find them. Why don't we celebrate this more? And why don't, you know, is there an opportunity to grow that component in the economy as well?
Absolutely. I mean, here we are recording a podcast, which is really an analogy for the future, right? It's this digital realm, the way that the world, you know, the world is flat, as they say, right? And it's globally connected and all these things. So these guys that, let's use an example, Dark Matter Labs, right? Mm-hmm. This guy started, arguably a North American expert in encryption, right? Works out of his basement or his living room or something, right? And employees, I believe, last time I talked to him, about 15 people. A handful of which are in Victoria and the others are other parts of North America and the world, right? Right? Because you don't necessarily need to have this corporate headquarters where you have the corporate hierarchy in the corner office, right?
Right.
So those trends are, I think, very revealing of, what Victoria could be in the future. And I agree with you. We don't celebrate them enough. We should celebrate them more. I think that's one of the jobs of organizations like the Greater Victoria Development Agency, like Viatech, right? To put these stories in the forefront, to talk about them as success stories. And more importantly, perhaps, is to attract more of them to happen, right? Through mentoring, to, you know, entrepreneurship support programs, attracting other similar-minded individuals to the community.
So, Dallas, one of the challenges facing GVDA, frankly, any regional construct on Lower Vancouver Island is this, the nature of our political governance. The fact that there's so many municipalities. I think GVDA has done as good a job as they possibly can to try to represent regional interests. And I think lately you are starting to, attract a national interest and national funding that can really accelerate your regional impact. And so perhaps talk a little bit about that. And maybe if we can then allow some of those fringe municipalities that frankly are doing very well, I say fringe geographically, and maybe if they get a sense of what you folks are doing, they might want to become more involved. Because I think you're really bringing a benefit and a potential opportunity to companies all around Lower Vancouver Island, even though it kind of doesn't work that way politically.
Yeah, that's a great point. So let me say two things. So the second thing I'll talk about is this new program that I think you're referring to. We got some federal funding for a three-year, we're calling a trade and investment program, which is serving the region, the Greater Victoria region. So I'll talk about that second. But first, let me say this. I had the, we all have heard the A word is going around, amalgamation, right? And they've asked me to, they said, write a paper about the way the economy could function in an amalgamated government. And I actually said no. And the reason for that is our board doesn't have a position on amalgamation because the economy itself is completely fluid and functions regional regardless of geopolitical borders, right? So our position is, well, if we were to go above and beyond all of those problems with local governments, the economy can actually function as a regional economy, and in fact already does. So
well, and a global analogy actually lately is that the U.S. economy now for the past year has shown strong signs of recovery, and the pundits, the national pundits, some of whom have podcasts, are mentioning how that's happening despite the dysfunctional scenario in Washington. Doesn't work. We don't need politics to work necessarily for economic development to succeed. But certainly I think GVDA offers a ton of benefit to a lot of companies. And like when I drive around and if I go to Costco, I don't think that I'm going to Langford. If I think that I'm going to go catch the ferry, I don't think that I'm going to North Saanich.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm doing that because that helps me live.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I get the separation. What are these programs you're talking about? How can they benefit local companies get better and realize opportunity?
Yeah, I mean, so quickly, or last thing on the point of the local government. So we meet with, I'm going to say, about 100 inbound investment groups a year. So not, in 2013, we met with 97.
Great.
Right? These people are looking
at... Hold on. Let's just really understand that. Like, that's a ton.
It's one every 3 days.
That is so much.
Yeah. Like, it's a, yeah.
I never knew that.
I didn't realize that either.
That's a ton of connectivity to the region.
Yeah, I mean, it's people are looking at Canada. Canada has one of the most stable financial environments in the world, probably the most stable, actually. So people look for people being investors from around the world, looking at Canada and saying, where do I want to look at in terms of, you know, streamlining money into Canada? And really, there's a handful of places. I mean, we get the MTV, Montreal, Toronto, Vancouver. But then people start looking at the kind of residual surroundings of those metro centers. Victoria benefits a lot of being a close proximity to Vancouver. Mm-hmm. And secondly, we're the second largest metropolitan region in BC. So the 15th largest metro in Canada, second largest in BC. Hmm. Sometimes we forget that because, like you said, we have all these little factions. Mm-hmm. But we are the second largest. So a lot of that investment comes in, and they're looking at the region in terms of stability. They're looking at it in terms of long-term, you know, real estate to business to all sorts of investment. Victoria is a very attractive environment for those things, right? We're not a fast growth market like Fort McMurray or Calgary or some other cities, but we are a very stable environment, often among the lowest, you know, lowest three or four cities in Canada for unemployment rate. So it's a very stable environment.
I want to ask you about the unemployment rate, Dallas, because I think that there's a feeling out there, it's palpable, that the economy isn't that great in Victoria. But then we look at the, employment numbers and we go, well, actually, you know, we're pretty good. And I wonder how much of that is, just kind of a mismatch on employment. I mean, just to give you an example, somebody in my family is gainfully employed, but not in the career that they trained for, and considers that to be, you know, not
ideal.
Not ideal.
Yeah.
And has been trying for years to find employment in the field that they were trained for, and have been unable to in Victoria, where if they moved to Vancouver or other regions, very likely would have found employment in that field. So is there a fair amount of that, or is you know, what is the underpinning of this? Are we just all so spoiled in Victoria that we just need to find things to complain about, or is there something to this?
Well, I mean, think about this in terms of Victoria's attractiveness as a place to live.
Yeah.
So what happens is we have the ability as an employer, any employer in the city can hire somebody. I was actually taught, well, look at Stantec. They hired a urban planner from Abu Dhabi, right? This guy built a whole sustainable city in Abu Dhabi, now living in Victoria doing projects for Stantec. So if you're a up and comer urban planner and you applied for that job, when you're competing with a guy from, excuse me, from Abu Dhabi,
yeah,
who's done all these things worldwide, you know, chances are that you're not going to get that job, right? Because right. Victoria is such an attractive place to live. We are much more competitive for that region.
We're often the first place somebody in the world wants to come to.
That's right. Hmm. Yeah. And so, I mean, what the investors that I look at are, and sometimes, you know, I'll give you an example. So I met with a guy about a month ago who spent 6 years at Alibaba.com. And if anyone doesn't know what that is, it's the world's largest e-commerce business, larger than Amazon and eBay combined, and then double. So massive, massive company, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, had 20 years experience in high tech in Beijing and Shanghai, Guangzhou, Hong Kong, right? This guy came to Victoria and wanted to invest in a business and ended up buying a grocery store. Mm-hmm. So if that isn't a clear example of what you're talking about, I don't know what is, right? Yeah. And so this guy's now living here in Victoria and went through successfully through what's called the Provincial Nominee Program, which is a business succession. The government can nominate people for streamlined immigration.
Yeah.
Anyway, now this guy's living in Victoria. So what do we do with that individual as a community? In my opinion, that's even though, you know, I don't think that we want tech millionaires owning grocery stores, but what we do want is tech millionaires moving to Victoria and then applying their talent to our community.
And starting tech businesses. Businesses in their field.
Starting, mentoring, you know, bringing in other entrepreneurs
exactly,
to grow them too, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And you know, and this is the sense that I get, you know, when the great job opens up, or even the not so great job, the entry level job opens up, and an employer is flooded with 300 or 400 really qualified applicants. You know, there's some kind of mismatch going on in the local economy.
Well, so as Dallas is aware, I do ECDEV work out Peninsula Way with the manufacturers, and have done some ECDEV work out Langford Way with the city, and the actual breakdown of company size and revenue lends itself to understanding this scenario better, and one that I'm sure Dallas and GVDA are their efforts are trying to change. So we might put numbers out there of billions of dollars of revenue, etc., but let's really start to break down what that looks like. And so recent research I've undertaken has identified somewhere in the neighborhood of about 120 manufacturing companies on Lower Vancouver Island, according to Canadian national standards defining what a manufacturing company is. You can go look at that. Of which close to half are on the peninsula. Of those half, likely a dozen are of the size and capacity that could actually help build an economy. They're in the 100 to 150 staff plus range. They're doing $20-30 million a year minimum. That's the kind of robust company we would all love to have many, many more of. Mm-hmm. That could take in that capacity that you were referencing, Paul.
Yeah.
But as in the MTVs, the Montreal, Toronto, Vancouver, you then have a secondary size of company that we don't entirely have here. That being that sort of 20 to 30 person company that has a stable cash flow, that has stable clientele, global clientele. That's not as strong here. And it's often filled by the public sector. And then you have a bunch of small companies trying to become big companies.
Yeah.
And so I think that's part of what it is. Like what, and so when you add up the revenue of all of that and the unemployment of all of those three, it looks pretty good. But when you actually try to fit yourself into it, there's not as much opportunity as we wish.
Well, and I think if I can just interject as well, just to that point, I think that's why, we get a lot of people whose careers are jack of all trade in Victoria. I don't think you'd see that in an economy like Vancouver and Toronto and Montreal as much, because we're, you know, people are either working in some very narrow, role in government, or they're working for a micro business that's sort of 3 to 5 people, and they're just doing everything, which can be very challenging and fun. And I did that for years. But, you know, if I was to go apply for, you know, a very highly specialized, position now at this stage of my life, it would be a little bit nuts, right? So,
yeah. So John, on that point, so you talked about, we have these larger employers, then we have kind of these second tier employers, smaller companies, and we need more of those companies. And that's exactly the reason why the Greater Victoria Development Agency designed our 3-year trade and investment program. Because we looked at that trend, and I mentioned it earlier about the 1,900 jobs lost in the public sector, and now we need to offset that somehow, right? So we said to the federal government, yeah, our unemployment rate is actually healthy on paper, but what's happening behind the scenes is we actually need to create more private sector job growth into the future to offset that. And if you ask, you know, if you ask Colliers, hey, what's the future look like in downtown? They're going to say, oh, well, either office space. And as you know, think about that, 1,900 chairs and desks from the public service in the region are now empty.
Right.
So, right, what does that do to our real estate business? What does that do to the demand for new developments? And what does the future look like for that? And what we need to do is offset that with new companies and their growth. So that's really what we designed that program for.
Well, that's neat. Likely you and I can talk offline. We have a global leader in aviation manufacturing with Viking Air here in our region. They employ here in Victoria maybe 400 plus people.
Yeah, 475 is the last number I got. So
in Calgary, another 150 maybe.
And they have a really cool office if you've ever been there.
Yeah, I really like it. And the government, the federal government has really had goals and objectives of trying to build aviation industry across Canada, and Viking is one of their sort of centers of influence. And so then one looks about how would one form an aviation center of excellence in our region? Well, as sort of a foundational spot, a place, why don't we first identify who's involved? Who are the suppliers? Who does aviation work in the region? And you actually find it really hard to determine that.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's Viking, and who else? And so here we have a global leader in aviation, and we have an opportunity to upfill smaller companies to feed that value chain. And we can do that probably a dozen times regionally. Is that the kind of mission and vision of your program?
Yeah.
Is to sort of do that upfill? Because I think that then lends itself very well to the entrepreneurship and startup flavor of what this region is trying to be.
Yeah, think about, I mean, the Viking Air is a great example, because if you look back to 2005, how many employees did Viking Air have in 2005? The answer is 180. So in 2005, they were also not an exporter of planes. They were a service firm.
So
what happened is they secured the rights to the out of production De Havilland aircraft, and they turned themselves from a service firm into an exporter. A manufacturer that exports, right? And so now, as John said, 400 plus employees as an exporter, 180 as a service firm.
Yeah.
And that's really the telling of the story that we're looking to uncover and create through this program, right? We want to help turn those companies that are around, either they're supplying, either they're a supplier and they can serve as other suppliers to companies that are outside the region, or they're, you know, serving a small audience, maybe domestically in Canada or provincially, or maybe even Pacific Northwest. And they're looking to expand, you know, taking a competency that they have into Asia or Europe or somewhere else, right? If we can do that successfully, then we can uncover other companies that can go that 180 to 475 like Viking Air has, right?
Yeah. Well, and I imagine that the geographic challenges that we would ordinarily associate with being in Victoria, vis-a-vis, being on an island versus, you know, no rail connections, things like that, could actually be an opportunity when you look at the Pacific Rim as well, right?
Well, that's an opportunity in that, you know, I'll use a story that was told publicly by Scott Phillips, the founder of Starfish Medical. He said, you know, when I first came to Victoria, one of my advisors said, you need to build something about this big, and I'm putting my fist up, so the size of your fist, and that costs $10,000, right? And if you can do that, you'll be successful, right? So what did Scott do? Well, he's in the medical business, so he produces products that are fairly small, easy to ship, but are very expensive, right? And so he's developed this, and through intensive R&D, they've become, you know, the success story that is Starfish yeah. Medical and Vivitro Labs, right?
Yeah.
And serving a global audience. And that's where I think the opportunity lies, is that if Victoria can attract quality, high competency people, we can develop quality, high competency businesses right. that serve global audiences. And therefore you're almost eliminating, I mean, yeah, it costs $90 more than shipping a crate from Seattle, from Victoria than it does from Seattle. But if your products are quality, niche, high end, then you've offset that.
Well, I know for a fact that Viking, obtains parts all across Canada, and one really has to wonder at some point, or examine at least, why can't we at least do some of that value chain here locally?
Yeah.
Scott Plastics, global leader in plastic manufacturing. Once again, where are they getting their parts from? They provide for marine industry. Amazing value. We're surrounded by water. You know, you start to look at, and that, to your point, Paul, then I think really what we can succeed at economically locally is building those sort of smaller, medium-sized businesses that could grow, that currently feed the global leaders, of which, interestingly enough, we have quite a few.
Yeah, absolutely.
Locally.
Yeah.
And so GVDA could be that vehicle, right? I mean, if somebody wants to try, if someone were to say, gee, I want to do that, they would come and see Dallas, correct?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, that's part of the job of economic development is to act as a convener. And that's a, you know, abstract word. But what it means is we're looking at connecting the dots between suppliers and those larger companies. We're looking at connecting people to various sorts of inputs that they may require to grow, whether it's capital or human resources or whatever. That's what we do. That's the whole realm of economic development is you're convening it. You're almost like a wizard stirring a pot, right? You're trying to convene the marketplace so that it acts at a higher level of performance than it did before, right?
And I understand Paul's frustration, and literally your generation's frustration that once you move beyond the public sector job opportunity here locally, it does become more difficult to find opportunity in large part because you're not just competing locally. You're actually competing globally.
That's right.
And boy, so that's not going to change because this region continues to be the best place in the world to live in.
Right.
Therefore, we have to increase capacity.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah. You know, I got a call the other day from the ICE program at UVic. They're basically their center for helping students and faculty start businesses. And they said, you know, we're looking at the marine, kind of the ocean science, marine, shipbuilding, ship repair kind of space and saying, what role can UVic play in that sector? You know, help us. They called me and said, hey, you know, can you help us identify this sector and kind of map it out so we can see where we fit? And where that kind of came from is that if you look at Ocean Networks Canada, Ocean Networks Canada is world leaders they have the world's largest underwater laboratory, first of all. They're sending that information that's gathered from that laboratory to the world. So any university in the world can access the research and the data that they're gathering on a day-to-day basis.
It's amazing.
Yeah. And they've really become world leaders, and they just got, you know, a bunch of funding from the feds to do more of this stuff. And so now you have the guys that are in charge of entrepreneurship saying, what can we do in this sector? That's really exciting for me because now you're talking about developing a university competency. We have a number of private sector companies that are in that space, whether it's environmental monitoring, you know, underwater competencies across the board. What can we do in terms of identifying gaps? Like we've talked about supply chains and things like that, and filling those gaps. And so one of the, I've been giving people this test lately where I say, you know, a company like C-SPAN, not based in Victoria, but very large employer here, very large presence in terms of, you know, physical space out in Esquimalt, and, you know, the future looks bright because they're getting this national procurement. But I said, you know, here's a test. How many local suppliers does C-SPAN work with in the greater Victoria region? It's a test I've been giving you. So I'm testing you both right now. What's your guess?
Five. they get their coffee. And
yeah,
they
got coffee.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, janitor services. Yeah. Yeah, there you go.
That's a great question, Dallas. I would be purely guessing.
Yeah. So I've been asking this people, and the highest guess I've got so far was 50. And the answer is 320.
Wow. Wow.
Okay. You know what this points out big time?
Wow. I apologize to C-SPAN. I was totally wrong.
One of the reasons we started this podcast is to try to have a deeper understanding of some of the business and social issues in our region. Because we find on traditional media, it's just the sort of topical political stuff that just is rehashed like 1,000 times over.
Us versus them.
And yet this information, just what we've heard from you in the last half an hour, amazing, startling almost information, isn't getting out there. Paul, might I suggest that we think about as we do this week in politics, a this week in business.
Absolutely.
And allow Dallas to tell us some of these stories, which frankly aren't getting out there. And that's not anybody's, that is something we can help.
Well, I certainly put an open invitation, Dallas, to yourself or any of the business leaders you're working with, to come on the amazing John, Paul, and Mike show to toot their horn because, you know, we need to be celebrating this.
Something absolutely. Like this week in business. So, so back to that C-SPAN piece. So let's just rephrase that. They're working with over 350 local companies.
320.
320. Yeah.
How many? 220?
320.
320. Local companies that are providing services to the local shipbuilding operations here in the region.
That's right. Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it's remarkable. Yeah.
Like, wouldn't that be neat if we knew what that same number was for aviation, for ocean networks, frankly, for education? Imagine if we started to look at how education is impacting our local economy.
I was actually going to ask, Dallas, I know we're getting close to our time here, but are there other industries? And maybe sort of I'll preamble that question. Is that kind of how you look at your role? Do you sort of start with what are the industries and what am I doing in those industries? Or do you just sort of start as a, you know, how can I facilitate whatever happens? Because undoubtedly there's industries that aren't here that might one day begin here, right?
Yeah, that's
Or do you focus on different industries? And if so, which industries have we not already sort of touched on?
Well, that's a good question. So that's really the philosophical kind of underlying of economic development is really you get to this crossroads where you either go down this path towards developing deep competencies as a city in a specific sector. And so the example of that is there's a city in Italy that makes 70% of the world's socks. Right.
So really?
Yeah, like this, imagine this, you have like this, you know, 40 year.
Is it Milan?
deep competencies in all things socks, right? They're about materials engineers and designers and import-export experts, right?
Yeah.
So there's this other path, which is kind of the opposite of that, which is going down the path towards creating an environment that's conducive to all things entrepreneurship. So any sector can thrive, right?
Right.
So I guess we have to ask ourselves, is Victoria positioned or do we have a deep competency, you know, that could get us global positioning in a certain one sector? And if the answer is yes, what is that sector, right?
Right.
And then the other thing is, well, do we actually say, oh, let's not go down that path and let's go down this path towards creating an environment where any sort of entrepreneur that chooses to do business here, whatever, regardless of sector, can be successful.
Right.
I say we do both.
Yeah, and that, I agree with John. I'm actually right now,
but not socks. That's already been taken. Down.
Clearly, socks is yeah, somebody socks knows that already.
Underwear, maybe. We yes. No, so as of Friday, so 3 days ago, I guess from today, we issued an RFP to do a study of our export capacity as a region. Fairly extensive. It's going to take about three and a half months to undertake. And our goal is to answer that question. Is we want to look at all of the companies that are exporting. Where they're exporting to, what competencies they have, and code them according to NAICS codes, and then looking at where they get their supply, like where's their supply chain located? Is it local? Is it domestic or is it international? Mm-hmm. Probably all three. Mm-hmm. And what we want to do is we want to mine that data in order to understand what our competencies are. I think we're going down that path where we know that we're in the ocean science marine space already.
Yes.
We have university, you know, more than one program in that area.
We have strength on the aviation side, as we already talked about. There will likely be seen to be strength. Interestingly enough, SeaStar Chemicals out Sydney Way, also a global leader in providing whatever chemical companies provide.
Yeah, exactly.
But doing business all across the world, as in, so can't wait to hear the results of that.
Yeah.
So, when you think tech, and this is, I guess, another sort of variation of the theme here. Tech is a big word. You know, it can mean a lot of things. Yeah. I mean, you know, you could lump aviation and a lot of manufacturing, especially high tech manufacturing, under the banner of tech. Mm. So, where are we heading with that? I mean, John and I both come from a digital media background. And so when I think about tech, I sort of automatically, you know, think about online and, you know, that world.
Right.
What are we missing? What else is happening? What else is a big growth opportunity for Victoria?
Yeah, that's a great question. And you said it. I mean, tech is a big word. There's a lot of, quite actually hundreds of companies in Victoria in the tech space, right? Mm-hmm. Whether they're advanced manufacturing, whether they're doing R&D intensive like Scott Phillips, like we talked earlier, Starfish.
Yeah.
Or whether they're doing where it's kind of the softer side, which is e-commerce and gaming and digital, all the digital stuff, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, I think the answer to that question is looking at the trends of the marketplace and what's seeing, we've talked about gaming earlier, right? Where just a few years ago we had a dozen companies, now we have 19, right? And you know, people called me the day after Microsoft left town, and they're like, "Oh, the gaming sector, what's going to happen?" And I think it was 3 weeks or something where all the employees of Microsoft created their own company, and so we went from 18 down to 19, back to 19, you know, 19 down to 18, back to 19 in literally 3 weeks. So that. It's creating it's kind of starting to self-perpetuate. It's, you know, in that gaming kind of niche within tech. Mm-hmm. And I think, there's probably quite a few others out there where we could actually kind of stir the pot a bit, right? As leaders in the community.
And gaming is very exciting because, they're well-paid jobs and
they're sustainable.
They're sustainable. Yeah. You know, with a few good products, a gaming company can, basically print money. And, it's an amazing opportunity. I think, you know, when you think of, movies, you know, in the movie industry, we had a big push years ago in Victoria, and we still have some of that happening. But, you know, gaming far exceeds, as an industry now, movies, which we thought we'd never, ever see in our lifetime. So,
well, it's likely you need to go and do some economic development stuff. So we'd really
go forth and build the economy, Dallas. We're going to go kayaking.
And if you could just leave some contact information for folks to get a hold of you, website, perhaps Twitter, perhaps email, phone, etc. And think about a more regular contribution that reflects some of what's happened in the last week or so in business in this region.
Sure.
And let's start to celebrate that, because I just think it goes unnoticed, frankly, and that's such a pity.
Yeah. No, it's a great. So what I do, I keep this little display in my office of all the kind of sometimes products, sometimes brochures, sometimes samples of items that I've gathered in face-to-face interactions with the region CEOs. And I put them on display because anytime I have an investor group in my office and they're like, oh, you know, tell me about the economy, I can actually actually hand them a product and say, yeah, this product is completely designed, tested, manufactured, and shipped 100% here in Victoria. And they're kind of saying, oh, wow, you know, and then I can use that product to actually shape the analogy of what type of companies are going to be successful here. We talked earlier about the niche and the, you know, niche deep competency companies that have a capacity to go global. And so that's really the story that I kind of untell there. But I think I'm rambling now. So anyway,
if someone
wants to learn
more.
Getting
excited about the exciting things
coming. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And there are lots. I mean, you know, we talked about the challenges, but there are so many examples of companies here that, you know, you go into these shop floors and you think, wow, like, you know, here's my resume, sir. You know, like, it's just amazing stuff that's going on and really world leading in many, many cases.
Well, I just want to say congratulations, Dallas, on the good work GVDA is doing. I know we've had the opportunity to cross paths a few times, and I'm pretty excited about where we're going as a region, and keep up the great work.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, so Dallas Gislason at www.gvda.ca, phone number 250-360-3478. I really hope that we get to speak to you again. Take care.
I would look forward to that very much. Thank you so much, Paul and John and Mike.
Yeah. Yeah. And John being the founding father. And welcome back to the John, Paul, and Mike show. We just had that sponsors break. Who's our sponsor this week, John?
I think it's coffee.
It's coffee. This week's John, Paul, and Mike show is brought to you by coffee.
Because I know you hate identifying the time of day or week, but it's a Monday morning.
It really
is. And our sponsor this morning is coffee.
Yeah. If you're looking for a sponsorship opportunity, let us know because we're really cheap.
And we reach 3.2 billion listeners.
Exactly. Every minute. So happy Pride Week, John. We just wrapped up. I know in my family, we went down and we saw the parade and my wife got all dressed up in rainbows.
Okay, yeah. Paul, I'm going to be controversial.
Yeah.
Okay? Because, you know, why not? Eh? It's Monday morning. I am.
You're not proud?
No, I'm a bazillion percent in support of what Pride Week represents.
Yep.
And equal rights for every person on this planet. Tell me why, however, I actually challenged my wife on this question. Why do we need a special week for that? Is that, and her response was a great one because in fact, the folks being represented through being celebrated in Pride Week have not had an easy time in the past. And now we're celebrating and identifying their place in our society.
Yeah.
Is that, because why do we need to celebrate this so much?
Yeah, yeah. I think you hit the nail on the head. And it was the same question that my 8-year-old son had for me as well a couple years ago. Like, well, I don't get it. And I just kind of said to him, I said, look, you know, there's some historical grievances here. Like, there's people who were treated very, very poorly by society. And, it's important as a society that we do treat everybody equally.
So could that end? Could, with a new generation of folks who think differently and who don't think anything, if they're talking to a homosexual, a lesbian, a bisexual, any kind of person who they don't care.
Well, and I think
would that eventually end?
I think your answer to that question is in really in the civil rights movement and in feminism, and how many people identify themselves today as a feminist? Where I was raised by a female, and I was certainly always raised to believe without any sort of even thinking about it, really, just conscious level, that men and women were equal And why wouldn't they be? And so for me, the notion of corrective feminism, where, you know, there's historical grievances that need to be, rectified. I always sort of do a double take when I hear it. And sometimes it is actually still legitimate because there's glass ceilings that exist and so forth. But, you know, my gut reaction is, well, of course men and women are equal. What, like, who would second guess that? But I was also born and raised as a male and never, didn't have to experience,
so you're saying life as a female. It could become more the norm. And there wouldn't be as a requirement for a week or a celebration.
I think though any excuse for a crazy parade.
On that note, I'm with you. So, hail to the crazy parades.
Oh, and I got a funny story I'll share with our podcast listeners. There was a lot of candy given out at the parade, and. My son had quite the stash by the end of the parade.
Sort of like on Halloween.
Yeah.
Did you have to steal some?
He volunteered some because he's not actually really big on candy, but okay. I've taught him how to hoard.
Okay. Yeah. Excellent.
So he managed to have quite a pile of, not very many condoms, handed out. But this year there was, towards the end, some groups were handing out condoms and my son asked for one because he's got all this candy. He's thinking this is going to be something good. So I had an interesting opportunity to explain to him,
the difference.
Yes. a condom and its application.
So a neat father son moment.
It was an opportunity and we crossed that bridge. Happy Pride Week and, right, you know, be proud, John.
Well, you know, it goes back to my point. I don't even think of those differences when I'm speaking to somebody. It doesn't even enter my mind, enter my evaluation, enter anything. It just, there's another person with a set of viewpoints. So interesting.
And you know, you and I are out there and, out there, but, you and I, know lots of people in the community. Mm-hmm. And so, in our travels, we're going to be interacting with a lot of people, who are gay, lesbian, bisexual, transsexual, et cetera. Just, you know, in our day to day, interactions.
It wouldn't even cross my mind that that's an issue or a sin. But I guess there are people who think quite the opposite.
Well, and I think for a lot of those people, it's because they don't have those interactions. If you live your entire life in a bubble and, you know, you have your 12 friends that you get together with for beers on weekends or whatever, and you just – you've never met people outside of those circles, you might kind of be afraid of that. You might be wary and wonder, you know, what's this all about, right? It's, you know, I think it's human nature to a certain extent when we don't understand a certain type of culture or a certain type of person. One of the possible reactions to that existing would be fear or, sort of the more negative consequences of fear.
Well, certainly. Hail to Pride Week and hail to crazy parties.
Yeah,
so absolutely. Let's do it. But kind of a slow political week otherwise, don't you think?
There's a few other things we could talk. I mean, the big one is my favorite tweet of my own this week was I stopped watching the World Cup as soon as Canada was disqualified.
Well, you know, I.
By the way, Canada never qualified.
Yes, I understand. Okay. it's quite a story. And I'm glad the fact that we're even talking about this issue means that it's making an impact. Okay, that's first of all.
Yeah.
But I was my parents are Eastern European descent. I'm actually my last name Juricic is pronounced Judicic, the Croatian pronunciation. So I have this cultural understanding of Eastern Europe. We lived in England for 3 years in the early 70s, right after England had won the cup in 1966. And so I get the soccer thing. Mm-hmm. The soccer thing globally is so deep. It's much, much, much deeper than the Canadian thing in hockey.
Oh, absolutely.
And it, yeah. Because so many poor disadvantaged people use soccer as a way to escape their terrible lives.
Yeah.
And I don't think we entirely understand that in North America.
You can put that in a microcosm here in North America. And say that, you know, it's the, you know, if children in Canada, don't have middle class or better parents, they're probably not, the kids are probably not going to go in hockey because hockey is a very expensive sport. Whereas kicking a soccer ball around a field has, some limited costs. You know, you might have your uniforms and you might have your shoes and your cleats and, you know, but really, it ain't apples to apples when you look at costs.
The sort of pride associated, now, I guess the theme of this week in politics is pride, but the sort of pride associated with your country doing well is deep rooted in social economic, sort of dysfunction in so many of these countries. And this sort of why watch soccer, you know, because our team is not in it. Our country's not in it. I'm certainly used to watching soccer, love the World Cup.
Yep.
And get the passion, the craziness around it.
Yeah. And I love soccer. My issue is, when there isn't a local team, I can't get enthusiastic about it. My family has an English heritage, but I don't have any particular affinity for England. Certainly, you know, I know people who are from, you know, Colombia and other places where, you know, their team is, you know, by proxy, whatever the country is that they originally came from.
The interesting story around the Colombian team, which is not in the cup anymore.
No,
right?
No, they got knocked out.
So this is the first time, I think, in three, so that would be 12 to 16 years of World Cup competition in which Colombia has a competitive team, because one of their star players, mm-hmm. who I believe you were familiar with the story, scored an own goal three or four World Cups ago. An own goal means you score on your own goal. And that man was murdered by a Colombia cartel member, and really sort of stopped the growth of Colombian soccer, as you can believe.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, if you don't do well, you're going to get killed.
Wow.
So but interesting, specifically in the U.S., how they're taking this love of their team soccer, mm-hmm. and making it so political that if you like soccer, you're automatically Democratic. You therefore automatically like Obama. Mm-hmm. Therefore, you are automatically hated by Republicans.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. Sports and American politics are so intertwined. And I don't think we see that to the same extent in Canada. Certainly hockey
a little bit,
but, you know, and it's interesting. If you ever go to a Whitecaps game, take a moment, look around the stands and look at who's there, and you'll notice that many of the faces are faces which are clearly immigrant or second generation immigrant
from
countries where soccer is huge.
Yeah.
And I think it's fantastic. But, you know, I hadn't thought about it until about halfway into the game when I went a couple of years ago and I looked around and I realized there's not a lot of pasty white people like myself, sitting in the stands.
Well, in the early 70s, we lived in England. I lived in Nottingham. And it was really the start of hooliganism at English football soccer games. And we lived in an area, middle class area, and I would play soccer. We'd play everywhere. We'd play on the street. We'd play everywhere. And there was a group older than me, so that would have been sort of later teens, that were going to these Nottingham Forest games. And these were skinheads, and they were going not to watch soccer, but they would go. They'd have the steel boots. They'd have no hair. They'd have the steel fist things to fight.
Yeah, brass knuckles.
So they were not going to soccer to watch soccer.
No.
There was class warfare going on.
Yeah.
And that was my first sort of exposure to how the game of soccer isn't entirely about soccer.
No.
It's about so many other things. And in North America, I don't see that happening as deeply as it does in other parts of the world.
Well, and the hilarious irony is because it was the people's sport in so many of these countries where it was the lower classes that got the opportunity, and certainly, you know, the questionable classes in some countries like England, In Canada, though, when you're a soccer fan, especially when you're a white soccer fan, there's this uppity kind of, you know, well, this is the real sport, you know, hockey is the down and dirty, and this is the upper class, upper echelon. I'm a sophisticated person because I watch soccer, which is hilarious when you think of it in the world context, because, that's certainly not a typical, I think, experience if you go to most countries around the world. But hey, let's talk about the real sport. Real Canada sport this year, or this week, which is tennis. What the heck, man? Wow.
You talk about sport and politics.
Yeah.
And sport and pride.
Yeah.
First of all, this young lady, Eugenie Bouchard, who Amazing. Was in the Wimbledon women's final, is going to be a global superstar for likely the next 10 years.
Yeah.
And if you heard her speak, or if you've heard her in the news interviews, such an articulate, well-spoken person for 20 years old.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. And then, of course, Milos Raonic, semifinals, one of our Canadians won at the.
Amazing.
And, you know, as Canadians, we've often been either criticized or characterized as not showing enough pride, as the Americans, you know, not showing enough sort of excitement about our accomplishments. Something I really don't agree with. I think we should cheer to the rafters every time somebody Canadian does something
Absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely. But I think we should celebrate anytime people are successful, right?
Yeah.
You know, why do we have to bash people, you know, or why do we have to be so reserved?
Why do we have to be reserved? And yeah, here we have these young tennis superstars.
Amazing.
Wow. What a proud week. What a proud week it was to be Canadian.
Yeah. Unless you're a spammer. How's that for a segue?
Wow.
Wow.
Well, so many of those good spammers are from Eastern Europe.
Well, and okay, so we're talking about CASEL, the Canadian anti-spam legislation. And, you know,
which started July 1.
Started July 1. Everybody's got that mailbox full of, please remain opted into my email that you've been getting for the last, you know, 10 years. And I mean, honestly, you know, I'm looking at it and I've signed up to 2 out of maybe 50 so far. And here's the problem I have with it as somebody with a marketing background who's done mailing lists. I kind of look at it and I go, what the hell is this actually going to change? Well, because all you're going to do is you're going to put these people who are trying to be legitimate businesses at a serious disadvantage, because just people are just too lazy to resubscribe, even if they are interested, right? So that's number one. Number two is you're not actually going to stop the real spammers, who are the ones who are sending you the Nigerian letters, you know, and asking for your banking information, right?
Well, a couple of things. I don't get a lot of spam. Actually, one can manage the settings of your email client so that you don't get a lot of spam.
It's not as much of an issue.
It's not an issue for me at all. It goes directly. I set up rules. I Outlook allows me to heighten the filters. So that's number one. Number two, I think this is a serious detriment to small to medium sized business marketing.
Huge.
Serious detriment.
Yeah.
I think it
it's
really
the one affordable way that they can get their message out.
Correct.
Without having to pay Facebook
Correct.
Or Google thousands of dollars.
And if you really don't want to get that email, you can unsubscribe.
Exactly.
Every single mailing list software allows you to unsubscribe.
Yeah.
Very, very disappointed with this.
Me too.
With this legislation.
Yeah.
I think it's hurting exactly the wrong people.
Yeah.
And I'm like you. I've received somewhere around a dozen, hey, you know, please
re-opt-in.
I deleted all of them. Like, it's not the nature of what I'm doing here. Like, they're not understanding these email lists. They're not understanding digital marketing.
No, they're really not.
They're not.
Yeah. Yeah.
This angers me.
It's terrible.
It's going to hurt small business.
Yeah, big time.
And they have to modify. Now, on a positive note, I hope. Mm-hmm. Apparently there's almost an 18-month to 2-year window in which this legislation is to be implemented.
Yeah.
Okay. So I think we're going to see somewhat of a kickback. I hope.
Yeah.
But if we don't, I think this is something the chambers should be We're broadcasting from a chamber here.
Yeah, yeah.
This is something chambers should take on in an advocacy role.
And a lot of people were freaking out. I've got two mailing lists for different companies that I'm involved with. And, you know, and I was panicking going, what the heck am I supposed to be doing here? I really encourage people, just a little plug for, my business partner on, social media camp, Chris Burge, go to his blog, bwest.ca, and read his article about, CSL. He really, hit the nail on the head. If people are panicking, small business owners are freaking out, go have a look because you may find it enlightening.
I think let's just reinforce that because I do believe a lot of folks don't have a clue what's going on and are just don't know where to go.
Yeah.
So that's Chris Burge.
Yeah.
His blog
B-West. Has
a summary of CASL consequences.
Yeah.
And implementation.
Exactly. Yeah.
So cool.
Yeah. So I think we agree on that really wholeheartedly.
That might be a first.
Yeah. That's exciting.
Wow.
So tell me but about
our guests don't really hear about what we talk about offline.
No.
Much more vicious.
Get out the knives. And have a steak dinner. So tell me, John, about these rogue bloggers out there who are exposing mayors' personal lives and what's happening there?
I think okay, so what we're talking about is a very popular, influential, but controversial blogger who exposed publicly on Facebook Vancouver Mayor Gregor Robinson's affair with a staff member. Okay?
Right, okay.
So multiple issues here, one of which is a privacy breach. Mm-hmm. Is that an appropriate thing to write about?
Right.
Number one. Number two, I think as the second issue being politicians, our political construct in 2014, I don't think can accommodate or understand how to deal with digital media. To tell you the truth.
No, yeah.
I think politicians like to use digital media to talk to people, but I don't think they know how to listen to people.
No.
And so this particular blog.
Some do. Some do. There's some exceptions. Do? Yeah.
Okay.
And actually, not that I'm necessarily a huge fan of hers, but Elizabeth May, for example, I've had conversations with her on Twitter. So she has figured out how to use it,
all right.
But I think she's in a very small minority.
So. Yeah, and not government yet.
No, that's right.
Yeah. Or in a position to actually influence policy in a serious way.
Politicians generally, there's a lot of fear factor in politics, right? People don't want to talk more than they have to. If you're a politician, you limit how much you talk because it's less opportunities for people to get you.
But correct. but that's not the world of digital media. So
exactly.
So they you have to find a way for those two pieces. I get the control part.
Yeah.
I get the control messaging part. It's a business. Politics is a business fundamentally.
Yeah.
But we're taxpayers. We pay their bills. Mm-hmm. So they have to learn how to. Yet this particular blogger seems to have. Generated a certain level of hate and anger that I've not seen anywhere by anyone else. Does he have a right to do that? Obviously.
Is it true?
Well, everything he says seems to be what one would say in a conversation between each other.
Right.
Does that mean it has a right to become public?
Well, there's a fine line between slander and journalism, right?
These are not untruths.
Yeah.
They're just stated in such a way that it would be similar to a conversation one might have in a bar.
Right.
Is that public discourse?
Yeah.
I don't know the answer to that
question. Well, we've been talking about this for years in the social media world. I mean, the reality is, and here's sort of a real world example. You went to high school. You know, when Facebook started, you went to college and Facebook was around, and now you're out in the job market. And in the interim, you've got, there's all kinds of party photos and all kinds of, you know, questionable things about you online. what used to happen, you know, when you and I went to college, without photographic evidence, is now out there. And so how do we as a society deal with this? Do we choose to ignore it? Does it become part of the issue? If if somebody was fall on the floor drunk and said, you know, ridiculously stupid things that made it onto YouTube, should they wear that for the rest of their lives? And this is the challenge, I think, of the digital world we live in.
Well, yes, there's a certain humanity that we tend to overlook when we examine digital media and its societal implications.
Yeah.
At some point at the end of the message, a human being is distilling that information. And so we're now not become robots. We've not changed just because communication channels have changed.
Exactly.
If I was an employer and I was to see randomly, somehow by chance, some unfortunate event of a candidate, of an employee candidate.
It's going to be hard to discount.
How could I not take that into account?
Yeah. Well, and especially if they're in a public role, if they're going to be in a public relations role. If you're hiring a computer programmer, who's sitting behind a desk, that might not be an issue if they're an amazing
programmer. So I think that's the piece we're missing is that even though there's now a bazillion ways in which communication and really, really democracy has fully extended itself.
Yep.
We are now an absolute democratic society, and all the good and bad to that.
Yeah.
There's still human beings with emotions and subjective opinions on the other end of those.
And all of this is going on, and I have conversations on Twitter with teachers who are saying that they shouldn't be teaching digital literacy to their kids.
Well, I'm sorry.
Sorry. Did I just segue?
Yeah. But that is a real bad understanding
it is
of what's going on.
It is a black hole. It is a black hole. And these kids, just set them out there, let them fall flat on their face with absolutely no, and you can give kids direction. You give kids direction. They may or may not listen to you. But at the end of the day, turning a blind eye completely, it's just, you're guaranteeing worst possible outcomes. And we've seen it we've seen it. Cyberbullying and everything else.
I got involved with what I call information revolution in 95.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's in some instances, before many of our listeners were born. And I was challenged
why. We have a
lot
of teenage listeners.
Yeah. Well, that's maybe. And So folks would say to me, well, why? Like, you didn't have an immediate job. You didn't have a startup. I said, well, it would appear to me that there's brand new ways of channeling and disseminating information to society. And it's incumbent upon me. I need to be accountable to my family to understand how that happens.
Exactly.
In the event that is done incorrectly.
Yeah.
Now, even though it wasn't digital, this exact same thing happened in the 30s. Mm-hmm. And Hitler, for the evil devil that him and all of his followers represented, actually reinvented communication and was able to generate a war that almost destroyed our societies because he was able to manage information better than everyone else.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm involved.
Yeah.
I happen to make a business out of it. Mm-hmm. Why we're doing this today is so that you and I can understand this. We can understand how information is delivered to our society better.
Yeah.
That's why we do this stuff.
Yeah.
So
number
for
two,
teachers not to respect and try to understand how this is impacting their kids doesn't make any sense.
And
to me.
School boards have policies, like no contact policies, because God forbid somebody should add their teacher on Facebook, and then they get into a crisis situation on Facebook. And they don't have anybody to turn to.
Yeah.
I mean,
So instead of ignoring it.
Because God forbid one of those teachers out there, and they're out there, might be some kind of a closet predator, right? And that's a good reason for the people that they see every day for 8 hours to not be in contact in the digital world.
Those closet predators were there long before the internet
exactly,
was formed.
Exactly. It's a completely outrageous, situation. And, I think some serious reflection needs to happen at the top level of policy.
Well, I think to me, you know, we've spent the last 5 or 6 years seeing brand new technology platforms emerge that impact social media.
Yeah.
I'm talking to you as a once again, global media, social media expert. I would love to see more dialogue on less on the technology and more on how all this stuff is being handled by our society.
Mm-hmm.
How are teachers, how is education handling digital media?
Yeah.
How's government and politicians managing? Yeah. We've just talked about it for 20 minutes.
Yeah. And the answer to, unfortunately, to those two categories is as little as possible.
Wow. Well, that just can't be.
No, it's
can't be.
Yeah. It's
sorry. This stuff ain't going away.
It's exactly right. I mean, it's one thing, you know, actually a really sort of off the wall example would be sex education, of a similar sort of thing. You know, we teach sex education in school, not to promote sex, but to, teach people, young people about what the heck their bodies are doing and the biology of it all and how to be safe if they engage in it. And we've decided as a society that this is important to do, right? So why the hell are we not taking that same approach, at a minimum, taking that same approach when it comes to digital media? Because they're all engaging in it anyway, and they're given zero instruction on how to be good digital citizens and protect themselves. It just absolutely blows my mind. Anyway,
let's keep this issue alive.
Yeah.
On our show because it's very, very important.
So fundamentally, we started talking about the mayor of Vancouver. That you know, in Canada, we have a long tradition of mayors and politicians having lurid affairs that we don't make a big deal about in the media. Whereas in the United States, that's always made a big deal of. Is this changing now in Canada? Are our expectations changing?
Well, I think the filter is an irrelevant one. It's not that politicians necessarily have affairs. It's a societal challenge.
Yeah.
It happens to be someone in public life has an increased risk of being exposed publicly. But it's not that they're more predisposed to having affairs.
Oh, I think they are.
Well, really?
Yeah, I think they are. I mean, you look at the stress of the job, long hours away from their families.
Especially one could say that about any business
person. Well, you can. But
a doctor, a lawyer, an accountant.
But politicians, where they you know, are in Ottawa versus
– physically changed.
Physically. And so, you know, you get the same thing, I suppose, with a trucker or whatever. And there'd be certain professions which would qualify in the same sort of role. Here's the other difference, though. Power is attractive.
Well, but here's how he reacts.
Am I right about that? Would you agree?
Absolutely. Power has always been attractive.
People find power attractive. And so, you know, even though you're –
since the dawn of time.
You're a hideously unattractive politician. You've got far more chances than the handsome janitor.
As opposed to me not caring, nor should I care, nor is it my business, whether my neighbor's husband – whether my neighbor is having an affair with somebody or not,
mm-hmm.
when somebody is in a position, when somebody's being paid by public money to create policy that could impact my community, then my opinion, what they do ethically and morally is of relevance to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's two sides to that. There's some folks who don't believe that and some who do. And therefore, if one chooses to go down that route, that is of interest to me.
Mm-hmm.
That exposes to me a certain weakness of morality that could impact policy down the road.
Right.
There are people out there who will beat me with a stick who don't think so.
Yeah. Well, and
so it goes back to the first, you know, the Pride Week thing.
Yeah.
Should I be concerned at all? Even Trudeau said this years ago, of what somebody does in their bedroom. Should I be?
Yeah.
Does that impact policy? Wow. Well.
in so much as it's consenting adults, probably not. the, you know,
consenting adults, but within, continuing to be within, within the framework of how we measure how we manage relationships with each other.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, and if you're married,
You've taken certain obligations. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I agree. If you're not, then you haven't.
It always baffles my mind when you hear about people having affairs, especially long ongoing affairs. And, meanwhile, they're still with their spouse and they put on the, you know, the fake sort of face that everything is fine. And I think of myself where if I was, you know, engaged in such activity, I would find it very, very difficult to, put on any sort of, you know, it would be, there would be too many internal issues, you know, which I would tend to wear on my sleeve, right? And so,
yet there's a historical.
So it kind of blows my mind when you hear these things and you go, like, how on earth do you manage that? Like, you know?
And yet there's a historical context of, to your point, you know, are we in a place where this is now has an increased chance of being made visible? My degree from UVic is in history, so of course I love historical references and analogies, but it would appear that in Europe, at the very least, this was commonplace. Mm-hmm. I mean, you would be married and you'd have a mistress.
Yeah.
Well, or the other way around.
Yeah.
And so it appears the world seemed to function okay.
Well, and it's, but it's a, it, there was also a different type of social contract, I would say too.
Right? Yes.
And so, if you're in a relationship where there's an understanding between the two people that there would be some extramarital, affairs, and maybe there'd be some communication around that. Maybe that would be okay, at least insofar as that relationship.
The social contract has changed.
The social contract. The social contract has, I believe, actually become, if you will, more conservative.
So to that,
since probably even the 40s or 50s, which we would consider to be a fairly conservative era.
So to that point,
I think feminism would be a big part of that.
Would social media, has social media changed that social contract?
I think social media probably hasn't a whole lot. I think you could look to feminism and women's rights as being the major contributing factor to that. At the end of the day, in a relationship where typically the man had extramarital affairs and the woman in that relationship was responsible for child care and that sort of and house, you know, household affairs, poorly chosen word. There was a stronger partner, right? And the stronger partner would have, in that situation, 99 times out of 100, had been the man. And so it's arguable that even though the woman perhaps was aware and went along with it, that she wasn't happy, but she was powerless to really do anything about it. In our current, social construct where women are empowered, they're just not going to put up with that crap. You know what I mean? And so, As a man who, you know, who might consider doing that sort of thing, not speaking for myself, you're not going to, a lot more risks come with that.
Well, and one of the rules, so back to the social media piece, whether it's impacted the social construct, one of the new rules of living within a new digital media world is that there's literally no privacy. Mm-hmm. That there is literally no place you can go where you're alone. There's always a camera. There's always something that could capture your behavior.
Yeah.
I don't think we've ever been in that position. And therefore you go around and you're never alone.
Yeah.
You are never alone.
Yeah.
And so I think for some folks who wish to become involved in public service and serve their community, they need to get that.
Yeah.
They need to get, they will never be alone and you can't break that rule. And there are folks all over the world, especially in Hollywood, trying to stop that rule from flourishing. But I'm sorry, it's here.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You're never alone.
Yeah.
No matter where you are.
Especially in the UK. There's a camera on every street corner. It's a fascinating topic. And, you know, I've been married for 16 years, happily, faithfully married. And so it doesn't occur to me too much outside of my life to think about how single people interact. And there's a whole other world there, online dating and hookups and everything else, sexting and the whole nine yards that we could get into. I just don't feel like I'm much of an expert when it comes to that sort of thing.
Well, we don't have to be. And I'm the same place. I've been married now 32 years, faithfully and lovingly. However, we are talking about how social media and that construct is impacting our politicians. And therefore, do we all collectively have a right to peer into somebody's private business?
Yeah.
And let's keep that discussion going.
Yeah.
But I think this week in politics, we have a little bit more to talk about before we wrap up.
By-elections, federal by-elections. So, so big surprise, Alberta, the Tories picked up the vacant seat. I'm kidding. I don't think anybody
expected otherwise. I think the surprise of these by-elections, Paul, was that the NDP, which in the last election, under Jack Layton's, under Jack Layton's amazing leadership, or perhaps lack of an effective opposition, became opposition party in Canada.
Yeah.
And I think Trudeau has managed to put the Liberal Party back into a two-way race.
Yeah.
I think it's Conservatives, I think it's Harper and Trudeau, and that was the message from this by-election campaign.
Yeah.
And that poor guy, Mulcair, whom I think is an amazingly effective parliamentarian.
Yeah, and very intelligent.
Has not been able to translate that vote into that expertise into voting success. And I think that is the case for the NDP right across Canada.
Yeah.
I think they need to change their name and they need to change what they stand for.
I agree. I mean, you know, we talked about this before. The NDP in Manitoba or Saskatchewan can form a competent government. You could disagree with their policies, et cetera, but they tend to be able to be competent. When we look at some other iterations of the NDP, I would lump British Columbia in with the federal NDP. They're still operating on a mandate that or sort of a philosophy.
Is old school.
A philosophy that doesn't work anymore. Left the world a long time ago.
Yeah.
And they all need to collectively move on. And there's definitely leaders within the NDP who are ready to do that. But, you know, there's certain breaking mechanisms that prevent that as well. But I mean, that's a whole other discussion. I think the tragedy from my perspective is, I'll be quite honest. I've never been impressed with Trudeau. I think he's an exceptionally beautiful person. But, beyond that, I don't think there's a lot of depth. I don't think his intellect would even come close to matching either Harper or Mulcair. Yet here's a guy who would make probably a fantastic backbencher, who's leading the party, and potentially could be our prime minister one day. And you see a lot of hate on social media towards Stephen Harper, and I get where that comes from. And sometimes I agree with the sentiment, but what's the alternative here? The alternative is this guy with fantastic hair and no substance.
Well, we have a federal election within the next year or 18 months. Do we know?
Yeah.
So we're going to now see these two leaders, Harper, our prime minister, and Trudeau, manifestation of a historical image, frankly.
Yeah.
Go at each other. Unfortunately, I don't think Mulcair or the NDP will have a role. They'll be relegated to their traditional third-party role. And, Paul, we're going to see whether Trudeau can match or can rise to the occasion.
And I think –
because there's some things he said which, frankly, shock me. Yeah. I agree with
you. Yeah, oh, yeah.
Canadians like that liberal place.
I know. And it's the natural governing party, et cetera, et cetera. I think it's very – I think it's very possible that the NDP could reemerge. And the reason I think that is because a lot of attention historically in elections has been focused on debates. There's no question that if a debate happens, it's going to be three-way. I don't think Harper would allow anything else, right? And frankly, I don't think the media would allow anything else. It's going to be three-way, possibly four-way with Elizabeth May as the wild card. I don't think she's going to garner enough support to maybe get more than a handful of seats. But Mulcair could really destroy Trudeau if he focused his energy towards him and positioned himself, I think, because he's intellectually outmatches Trudeau, I think 2-1. I think he has the opportunity to really, pick it up when it comes to that level of the campaign.
Yeah.
And that could be a turning point.
That could be a turning point, yes, I agree.
But failing that, I'd have to agree. I think we'd be looking at a conservative minority with a liberal opposition, and a couple more years for an election that could possibly put Trudeau in the prime minister.
Well, and I know we'll get to this more. And we should likely wrap it up.
Yeah.
For those folks who are listening to our podcast on the radio while they're driving home.
Yeah. This is a long one.
Yeah. I really look forward to seeing how those accidental NDP MPs out of Quebec who were elected, and they're all young.
Yeah.
How they change the dialogue in Canada. 'Cause at some point, young people are going to wake up and realize it's theirs to lose.
Yeah. 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 And we haven't seen a lot out of them. And
we have not.
It'll be interesting to see, if they take center stage in a campaign. You know, since Mulcair is personally not so popular, having a team sort of, campaign may actually expose some hidden talents.
Well, Paul, for Monday.
Yeah.
And for really not a lot of coffee, I think we've done okay.
And for a slow politics week, I think we're just about up to 45 minutes.
We've been able to spin a lot up. So till next week, my friend.
Enjoy the kayaking and,
mountain climbing.
Always a pleasure.
Bungee cording.
Spend this time with a founding father. John, take care.
Take care, you too. Bye for now.